Follow.
Into the breach, dear friend, else close the wall up with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, at this point, we're supposed to say that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program that happens to mysteriously appear on the airwaves and internet waves. Are there waves on the internet?
There are, okay. But they're different kind of waves.
Okay, well, all the waving goes on.
It's more like breakdancing waves.
The live waving goes on Saturday mornings, and the and that's what it does. But it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the SEC, which neither approves nor disapproves of this, and the tape will self-destruct in 10 seconds.
Should you accept the mission,
yes.
The we'll SEC, disavow everything.
The SEC yes. will disavow any approval or disapproval.
Right.
And all the stuff we talk about here, even though we are an investment advisor, we are the two principals and advising members of an investment advisory firm. This is not investment advice. This is educational information, and it is information we have obtained from sources we believe to be quite reliable, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Barron's, the United States government. Yes, they do give out good information from the United States government.
Occasionally.
Well, actually, the places we get it,
they're pretty apolitical.
They really do good because they're actually things that are stacked against the wall with drawers in them called bureaus.
Yes, and they're counting things.
Yeah, yes.
There's 12 of those, nine of those.
We love the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
47 of those over there.
And we love the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I mean, I would really love to go visit these places because
I think if you showed up, you would be very bored. There's probably a lot of quiet, and it would smell like pencils.
I have this image of a semi-darkened room with lots of people sitting at desks with little desk lamps and little green eye shades over their,
right.
over their eyes.
Somehow, I don't think that's the way it looks anymore.
Scribbling on spreadsheets.
I think it will look a lot more like the place that you go to renew your driver's license.
Well, you know, there's got to be a lot of really smart, detail-oriented people there because
– yeah, they're just like the driver's license.
One of the things they don't do is come back and say, whoops, we messed that one up. They just don't do that.
They come back and they do – in our normal revision, we have more exactly counted these things instead of the assumptions
there's
that
more
we used
data
last time.
In, yeah.
The third time, we've got the exact count. It's only about 8 months late for you to use it in real-time yeah. data, but there it is. Now yeah. we can look back in history and know what can – what happened.
And, you know, they are now just now releasing a lot of information from those bureaus about what happened in February.
Right.
Which means that they took a lot of time to gather the information.
Right.
They gathered the information at the end of February.
Yeah. So they've got the February release of a bunch of data. This is the first release.
Oh, yes. And so, there'll be two more.
And almost all the data that we talk about, whether it be GDP or new single-family home sales or new orders of durable goods or any of those other unemployment, that stuff gets revised over the following year. With GDP, it can be revised years after the fact when they've got all the data together. But it's kind of like going to a doctor and getting some preliminary vitals. We haven't talked about what's really happened this week, but we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I was looking at the Wall Street Journal yesterday.
That's scary.
The Fed is looking at the unemployment rate to sink to 3.6.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you guys always talk about 4.5% is considered full employment.
Right.
So, anyway, the article is projecting inflation. I was curious if there's any other time in history that the unemployment was going to go around 3.5.
Good question. Thank you for the call.
As a matter of fact, it did in recent history. In the late 1990s, it got down into the threes. And yes, we did have inflation. And matter of fact, inflation cooked up around 5%, I think, in that time period. And the Fed raised interest rates a lot, and then the market went, whoops.
Yeah, let me explain that, or let us explain that. We'll talk about what happened in the markets, but this is something people – by the way, this is fantastic. You'll love
fantastic.
This.
This is fantastic.
You'll love this.
This is a fantasy.
My wife's cousin's husband. How's that for an
Your
indirect –
Your wife's cousin's – oh, that's
– that indirect
approach. Wait a minute. We said that we quote from sources we normally deem to be reliable.
Well, this is a one of those things where –
My wife's cousin's husband. Okay.
He said to me, I do not believe in inflation. I believe it's just a bunch of people lining their pockets. And I laughed and I said, that's a pretty good definition of inflation. It's everybody lining their pockets more for the same products. It doesn't make people wealthier. If everybody charges more for the same products, then all the prices rise at the same rate, or close to the same rate. There's sometimes when some prices rise faster than others. But the reality is that nobody really benefits from large inflation, just like nobody really benefits from large deflation. Well, rich people benefit more from deflation. Poor people benefit a lot less. So in the case of inflation, nobody really benefits.
I would argue that, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's put the side note. Who will benefit if we get a lot of inflation? If you've got a good mortgage right now that you've gotten in the last 4 years, you will benefit from inflation.
Right.
Because your interest rates are set, and if money becomes worth less over time.
Mm-hmm. Anybody who has borrowed a lot of money at a fixed rate when inflation comes along smiles a lot.
Right. Deflation, anyone who has loaned a lot of money smiles a lot.
Right.
So, because people still have to pay back at the same rates as when they mm-hmm, borrowed the right. money. So when money becomes worth more, that's called deflation. When money becomes worth less, you can buy less with it. That's inflation. If everyone has a job, there's nobody without a job, then the competition for workers means that we've got to start bidding. If you think about all of the employers out there, they've got to start bidding like an auction against each other for employees. Even the lowest paid employees see their income rise, which means you would think, well, now they've got more money, they can buy more things. Except the same people that are employing them have to raise the price of the products that they're selling so that they can afford to pay the employees more. Otherwise, they can't pay the employees more. They're not going to go into a loss mode just so that they can pay new employees more. That's not going to be what happens. So they have to raise their prices. Everybody raises their prices at the same time, which means all those raises, all that bidding war over hiring new employees amounts to nothing because there's bidding wars on the employee side at the same time that everybody's raising their prices to pay for mm-hmm. the bidding war on the employee side. It's part of when we talk about trade, it's the same thing. If you just start stacking extra cost into the same product, you've got to raise the price of the product. And if one price is going up and it's connected to a lot of other things, then those other things' prices are going to go up too.
The catch in this situation where we are today, and the reason we haven't had much in inflation so far, actually we are having inflation.
Yeah, we've got inflation now.
But it's showing up in an area that, well, I'll talk about in a second. It's only, but the areas that we normally, that are most commonly looked at, particularly by the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Department and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who, where they get this stuff, are things like manufacturing. Now, manufacturing and goods that you buy, whether it be at Amazon or someplace else, are actually all other things considered cheaper now than they were in the past. The prices have been falling. We talk about flat screen TVs. The price for a better and better and better flat screen TV keeps getting lower and lower and lower. Manufactured items prices are falling because of a tremendous drop in the cost of transportation and communication. Your local, if you lived in a little town and whatever price it was in a little town, that's the price it was. Now Amazon is competing with the retail dealers and in the little town that you're in. And it, so the prices keep getting forced down. And we also have this issue of if we raise the price on something here in the United States because we have higher labor costs, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is that if you can get it from overseas and have it shipped here, including the shipping costs, and have the price lower, then we can manufacture it here. Then the fact is that you can't raise the price, so the company shuts down and goes out of business. That makes it, and that's one of the problems, of course, we run into. Here's the issue, though. I went and got a haircut the other day.
Which one?
A haircut and a beard trim.
Okay, the beard trim, there's a few more
and a few years
in
ago,
your, on your chin than on your
a
head.
A few years ago, I got one. And, I mean, I get them fairly regularly, but I went to a commercial place that's open 7 days a week. And, you know, so it's a good pricing mechanism. It cost me $25 to get my haircut and beard trim. Just a few years ago, it was $10 and I would give them a nice tip. So that is a lot of inflation. But you see, we can't import a haircut and beard trim from China.
Well, you can, but they're called wigs.
Yeah, well, it just doesn't work real well. So the thing is, we're starting to see competition for wages. So that and I just heard this yesterday from one of our from a person who just who commented that the cost of living in the Austin area and north of the Austin area was so high that the jobs that are going begging right now, the ones that are available for an educated person, don't pay enough money to pay for that person to be able to live, a single person to live in the greater Austin area. And that goes all the way up to Georgetown, Round Rock area. And that is a strong indicator that we're not very far from seeing those wages start to go up because they're not able to find employees. And the issue is, once the wages start rolling upward and the competition starts in to force those wages upwards, because, I mean, there's a fact. And the fact is that if you're running a restaurant, you got to have waiters and waitresses. You got to have a greeter. You got to have all these people. And if they're not, if you can't find people at $15 an hour, which is what they're generally paying right now, they're going to have to start raising the wages. And once they start raising wages, people will be spending more money, which means that the demand goes up and the price goes up for things that can't be imported. That's what the Federal Reserve is afraid of right now, with good cause, and that is very likely what we're going to see in the next year or two.
All right, there's a let me hit the last part of what the caller was saying about we're very near full employment. We're in the 4 area. We want, and they're talking about getting down 3.6.
Mm-hmm. That's when you start to get the noise.
Right. When we look at, there's some numbers here. Labor force participation. What does that mean?
Well, is it participation or precipitation?
It's not raining labor.
Well, the last report we had where the extra 800,000 people showed up, they precipitated
right.
out of the non-existent labor. They just came from nowhere.
Right.
You know?
Well, they came from somewhere, and this is the point.
The big question is where is it they came from.
Right.
Yeah.
The labor force participation rate in 1967, 97% of men between the ages of 24 and 54. Okay, why is that age range used? Because that is considered the prime working age. Some people retire at 55. They're rare, but it happens. So when we look at that, people in that workforce group, 24 to 54, it's a pretty good, or 25 to 54, it's a pretty good representation of who's working and who's not. You're still going to get people that have retired at age 62 and they may want to come back to work. So let's look at the people that, for most of our opinion, this is the working age. This is an age where if you had an early retirement in this time period,
so
it's extremely rare.
Is 97 point?
In 1967,
right.
Men, we had a 97%.
So what is it today?
88%.
Mm.
But the overall labor participation was 71% in 1967. It's 81% now. So we've got an extra 10% of our workforce, and our workforce is a lot bigger, working today.
But they're not men.
There's a lot of women added in. So in 1967, only 47% of women were working, and now it's 75% or 74% of women are working in that age group.
Do we have men, women, and other?
The other is not being addressed by the
Department of Labor yet.
Bureau of Labor Statistics. At some point, they might. It's actually the Congressional Budget Office that is doing this particular report.
Oh, well, they wouldn't address the other.
So they wouldn't address that. So if we go back to 2006, so pre-recession. Recession happened 2007. 2006, 91% of men in this age group were working. Today, it's 88%. That says that even if we're saying we've got a 4% unemployment, there's still room for about 3% more of the male population to be involved. So what this tells me very, very clearly is that women were less affected in their employment than men were.
And
because in 2006, 75% of this age group of women were working, and today it's 74%. Of course, 2017.
And I don't think it's coincidental that the opioid epidemic, as it's called, in rural America is primarily men.
Yeah.
And so, it's men within that same age group that you were talking about.
Right. So when we look at this and we say, where did these extra people come from? One, we don't have as many people employed in either the man side or the woman side of the employment force from what we had in 2006. Even though, you know, so let's take a step back. What does it mean when people say unemployment then? What is that? Well, that's a survey that's done to say, are you looking for a job? Do you want a job? If you there's that survey, then there's the other end, people that have signed up at an unemployment office to say, I'm looking for work and I don't have a job. So they take those two numbers and kind of look at them separately. They get your percentages out of that.
Then they confabulate them.
And they confabulate them.
That's my word for
today. It's very confabulous. They stick those numbers together. But when we look, there's still some room, not a great deal of room, in that prime workforce age to have more people come into the labor force. They're not in the labor force now. They have stepped back for whatever reason during the recession, and we haven't seen that number rise back up. Now, in the early 90s, 93% of men were working and 74% of women. Now, 88% of men, 74% women. So it's the same as the early 90s as far as the numbers for women, but we've got 4%, 5% less of the men working. Now, some of that could be that men have taken over a traditionally homemaker role. That's not counted in here. If they're at home taking care of kids, that is an acceptable thing. It's something that when we look at the economy, it's really, really good for the next generation to have somebody grooming that next generation for the workforce. Somebody spending full time with their kids is the statistics on that is pretty positive for the next generation, while it's kind of negative for the current generation.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say? We got to get back to what happened this week, too. We haven't even talked about the markets yet.
Let's just move on to the markets.
Okay, let's do that.
By the way, the telephone number in here, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if today is the 24th of March, it is then that means it is the third day of spring where you are. And
third full day of spring. So there was kind of a partial day in the middle between the 20th and the 21st.
Well, the 22nd was the first day of spring.
Has more to do with the length of day and night.
Okay, whatever you say. It's the third day of spring. He says it's the third full day of spring. We will not agree to disagree. We will accept that both are truth, and so truth is undefined.
Does the sun rise in the east, or does the earth spin?
Turn, yeah.
Yes.
Well, it all depends on how you spin the statement.
Yes.
If today is the 24th of March, 2018, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call, 254-773-1400. As far as what happened to the markets this last week, it wasn't very pretty, and it is we could spend the entire 2 hours talking about it, I think. I could, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
The S&P 500, the one we follow the most closely for the week, was down 5.95%. Year to date, this is probably more important, it's down 3.19. 52 weeks, it's up 10.42. Now, it was up a little earlier in the year. It was up like 25% for 1 year trailing, and now it's up 10% for 1 year trailing. Also very important is there is a sort of psychological consensus or something or another that 10% down from a peak constitutes a correction. And once it passes that 10% point, it has a tendency to fall almost on its own for no particular reason other than the fact that it's fallen this far, therefore it's going to fall some more. And we're down 9.91% from the peak that we hit on January 26th. A lot is going to be read into what happens on Monday. Monday is going to be an interesting day. If the market recovers nicely, then all is well. If
the
market
stations
starts its starts grinding downward again or falls on Monday, then we're going to have our first correction in a long time. And this one is statistically long overdue.
Well, we had a correction. This would just be an extension of it. We had a correction.
Well, we didn't have a – did we have a full 10 – we didn't have
yeah,
a full
– it was down 10% for one day. It closed down 10%.
Yeah, but
– and really, then it recovered back up.
But
so
we're actually a lot lower now than we were then.
Right. Well, we're within a few percentage points. What I'm saying is that most corrections have a double dip. This may be the second dip for that correction, or it could just be that this is the real part of the correction rather than the one that we had before.
The important thing to realize as we go through this is that it may not technically be a correction yet, but this is a correction, not a bear market. Now, what's the difference? Well, there's lots of difference. For one thing, at this point in a bear market down 10%, the consensus is that it's not going to go down any further. This is a temporary bump. Buy in quickly, and the retail people start buying in. The retail investors, the people in their 401k start moving money into the market more if they have any money left to move, and they generally don't at this point in a bear market.
We're not in a bear market.
Right. If this were a bear market getting started, you don't know if you're in a bear market or a correction until you look back in history and see where you were. So you can't look forward and see it. But among other things, bear markets and recessions go hand in hand. You can have a down market, a lot of corrections with no recession, but it's hard to separate a true bear market and a recession. You just don't get them. And the leading economic indicators came out Thursday. And there's actually two of them that are down just a little bit, but overall, the leading economic indicator index is up very nicely.
Let me hit the ones that are down because this is important. Housing starts declined 7% over the month before. So down 7% from January, or about down 4% from a year ago. That sounds bad because we talk about housing starts as being a really, really important part of the economy. And it is, it's a negative, but it's not as bad as it sounds. What this is, I'm going to use the word, an inflection point. After the recession, during the recession, new starts were primarily focused in multifamily homes. People couldn't afford to get a mortgage, couldn't afford to get their own home. So a lot of investors were going in and buying duplexes and apartment buildings and quadplexes and so on. So that was a big chunk of the recovery. These people that were moving into apartments were in apartments. They wanted to own their own homes. Most people that are in an apartment at some point wish to own their own homes. That's not everybody, but most of them. So let's dig into the numbers a little bit. Single family starts are up 2.9%, and they're up about the same percent year over year, while multifamily starts are down 18.7%. This is an inflection point. This is the point we've been talking about for a long time. There's a two-stage cycle that goes on in the real estate market, starts, stops, and so on. There's the multifamily side, which tends to lead the single family side. Investors tend to buy multifamily dwellings to rent to people that cannot afford their own home. Do you follow that?
I do.
Fairly well?
I
okay. Do. So if you can't afford your own home, you're going to rent in an apartment or a duplex, something like that. You're in it. It's very, very cost effective for the investor during that time period. Once we start to see saturation in that area, there's too many multifamily homes out there. There's too many apartment complexes, too many duplexes and quadplexes. So the competition for rent starts knocking down the cost, which allows the people that are staying in those rental places to gain more advantage. They start saving more and are able to get out of the multifamily house and into a single family house, which is why we're seeing single family home starts going up. It took single family starts a lot longer to recover after the recession than the multifamily. So we're starting to see the transition from multifamily to single family. That's good news long term, unless you own rental places with lots of duplex type situations. Then just expect to see the competition in that area continue to rise as more people leave those facilities for their own homes. And they've already been overbuilt, which is why there's a big drop in new construction there. There you go. That was my take on why one of the leading indicators is down. It's okay. Because we've got one stage
and
housing starts dropping while the other stage is still rising.
And the other one is the stock market. I don't think anybody was surprised to find that.
No. Down. Yeah. Leading indicator of the stock market being
but
down.
The annualized rate for February, for the rise in the index of leading economic indicators, is an 8.2% annual rate. Now, the last 6 months leading up to February, the growth rate was 2.4%. So that shows, as of February, and it's very important to remember this here, what we're about to say, a lot of the data that we're going to be talking about today is as of the end of February. That's all the stuff that came out from the government. And it was on March 1st. That President Trump tweeted that the steel and aluminum tariffs were going to go into effect. So we have a very optimistic view we see an optimistic view. We see all of the numbers indicating through February that we had an accelerating economy, particularly in the manufacturing area, surprisingly good acceleration in the manufacturing area, so that we have – And there's a 6 to 12 month lag, meaning is if as of February, the leading economic indicators were very, very positive, and they were.
Yeah, just to hit that, to give the numbers, industrial output or industrial production rose 1.1%. New orders for durable goods rose 3.1%. Those are both really big numbers in
for
that
one
area,
month. Yeah.
For 1 month.
Yeah. And so we've got across the board, and we got executives anecdotally saying we really feel good about this. On March 1st, the president started tweeting about tariffs. And so a month from now, we're going to get another release of leading economic indicators. We're going to get all this data again. This is, if you're at all interested in where the economy is going or what it's doing, which we are, obviously, this is a point where you can mark a benchmark. This is the economy without tariffs. Accelerating, hiring more people, growing very nicely. Almost everything in the economy is going right. It's what we call a Goldilocks economy. It's growing very nicely, but right. There's not any big inflation showing up.
We're not seeing too many hot spots
right.
or cold spots. They exist, but they're not horrible at the moment.
But here's the irony, and I was going to throw, we can talk, hopefully we'll talk about this more later. Steel and aluminum manufacturing companies. These are the people who make steel and aluminum, U.S. Steel and Century
Alcoa.
Steel. And these big companies last week saw their stock prices typically drop, well, over, not necessarily, the last 2 weeks they have seen their stock prices drop by double-digit amounts. Now, they had risen based on an accelerating economic activity in February. They were holding out very nicely as the market was kind of stumbling around after the end of January. They were holding very nicely, and obviously you would think if the president is going to impose tariffs on imported
– first thought, that should be good for this industry, right? Well, that's the knee-jerk reaction.
And initially they popped a little bit, but as of the last announcement of tariffs against China – they dropped like the proverbial rock. And manufacturing across the board, the executives from manufacturing firms are uniformly, I couldn't find a single positive statement from any of them, saying that instead of having a good momentum with acceleration going into the future, now they're saying things are not going to be as good as they thought they were going to be, and some are suggesting that if this continues to escalate, because, you know, we've gotten counter tariffs now announced by China and some announced by the European Union, they could go into decline. They could start laying people off and shutting down factories. This is something that doesn't make the headlines. You see the big headlines that, hey, we're going to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum. How much it'll raise the price is anybody's guess at this point. But the point is that the threat of a general tariff war with China, from whom we import a lot of stuff, has really got the manufacturers in America scared at this point.
Let me address something, because people have heard us talking about tariffs not working and think that we're denigrating our country or something like that. China has a lot of import tariffs, a lot. Japan used to have a lot more than it does. The idea that we're starting the trade war is only that we're reciprocating with China, which is a big shift for what we have done in the past. What we did in the past is they would put a tariff in and we would say, we're going to compete with that, but we're not going to put a tariff on you very much. There was some.
They don't have – excuse me if I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here. My understanding is there's not so many tariffs. It's issues like we won't license you to operate in
right.
China or sell in China unless yep. you transfer some technology to us.
Right. It's a different form of tariff.
Yeah.
It's an intellectual tariff rather than a monetary tariff. You've
got to
give
us your –
they're
not violating the WTO rules.
Right. Our response to it has been – well, they've – technically violated the WTO rules a lot in intellectual property, and
right.
their copyright infringement and trademark infringement is just through the roof. It is absolutely unchartable. It is so much copyright infringement, trademark infringement, that it's basically if you're buying from a Chinese auction house, you're going to get fake goods. They may be sort of quality, but probably not very quality. They're fake. And that's a real problem. So mm-hmm. what you won't hear us say is that China's the good guy here. What you won't hear us say is that the rest of the world is doing this correctly, because they're not. We have been the symbol of what correct trade is supposed to be, in that we have allowed a lot of other people's goods into our country without charges, that we're now kind of reversing on that. That we've still got a lot of tariffs with a lot of countries. Now, only countries we haven't had them with have been free trade agreement countries, and even them,
well,
occasionally.
The president seems to be very upset about the balance of trade.
Yeah.
And we've said this before. The balance of trade is a fiction. It is based on a lot of old assumptions.
Old data.
And it was – the whole concept was set up, and when everything was manufactured in one place, you know, you had – if you had a car, it was manufactured in Detroit, and you either exported it or you imported one that was made in Japan, for example.
Right.
Today – a given car that you buy in the United States might be have parts in it or been assembled in five or six different countries.
Let's go one step further than that. If you're Microsoft, little companies like Microsoft mm-hmm. or Adobe, those numbers are not tracked at all. There is no physical export. There is no physical import. What you have is a payment now on a subscription basis that mm-hmm. is totally right. not tracked in our numbers when we say we have a trade deficit. It's just not there. If Apple iTunes is being paid for in China, that's not an import or an export.
And to give you some idea of how goofy this is, the president has stated on several occasions that we have – a massive trade deficit with Canada. And if you look at the whole picture, no, we don't.
It's the other way around by a huge margin.
We have a large trade surplus with Canada. We don't have a manufacturing trade surplus with Canada, but they use so many services for which they pay people in the United States. It's a complicated issue. And basically, China has been cheating. Nobody questions that China cheats. But us cheating
doesn't make it better.
What happens is China's actually gotten better, and they're getting better very slowly. They're not getting better fast enough. The way the tariffs were announced and the counter tariffs, which, by the way, go against agricultural products.
Right.
Pork, which are really going to
grains.
It's really going to hurt farmers in the United
soy.
States. Is trying to – you've got this very bothersome housefly in the trade agreement.
Right.
And it's a big housefly, and it is
shoot very, it with a shotgun.
Very, well, it's more like walking through the house and slamming a sledgehammer to try to kill the fly.
Right.
First off, it's not going to kill the fly. You're not going to change China's policy. $60 billion putting tariffs on $60 billion worth of product that are imported to the United States, but to nobody else. If you look at the total exports from China, and that isn't even the size of a fly. The issue is, if we get started in a trade war because we broke the rules. The rules are, by the way, you go to the World Trade Organizations and you say this is unfair and this is unfair.
Right.
And
we agreed to do that.
They judge and say, yes, you can impose a tariff on this because this was unfair. But instead, what we've done is unilaterally, using some obscure laws from a long time before we joined the World Trade Organization.
1962.
We're imposing tariffs that are clearly targeted against a set of industries and a nation simply because we want to.
Right.
And if you don't follow the rules, things get kind of rough. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I have a question for you guys. I don't know if anybody's even thought about this. Do you realize how many aluminum plants we have in the United States running right now?
Quite a few, I think. Probably no, 8 or 10 altogether.
Wrong.
How many do we have?
You're wrong. I think we have two.
I'm going to check
and most
on
of them
that.
Are, well, if
well,
if
let's
you
put it like
around,
this. We have more than two
14
companies.
14 are down.
We have more
14
than.
14 are down.
But we have more than two companies in the United States that are manufacturing aluminum in the United States. So unless they're sharing.
Who are they?
One of them is Century. The other one is Alcoa. And there were some others listed
the only
in the article.
Ones that are, well, the only ones of the aluminum plants that actually are operating are Alcoa. And one,
so
those
Century,
are hydroelectric.
So Century Aluminum is whose stock just
went
down.
They're not American owned.
All right, we've
got American owned.
I'm going to refute that. Hold on a second. Ferndale, Washington, and Messina, New York, are both plants that are fully operational from Alcoa. Those are the
hydroelectric.
The two
hydroelectric.
Wait a minute.
They are hydroelectric, but they're aluminum smelters associated with the hydroelectric. So the aluminum. Hold on. There's a lot. Alcoa has a lot shut down. There's, we're quibbling because there really are only a few plants, aluminum plants, open in the United States. It's more than two, but there aren't that many.
There's only two plants that are open right now, according to the news.
Century Aluminum has one in Kentucky, Hawesville, Kentucky. Alcoa has one in Messina, New York.
They're not American.
Wait a minute. They are operating in the United States, and they're employing people. Wait a minute. They're operating in the United States. They're making aluminum in the United States, and they're employing workers in the United States. That's what we're talking about, plants.
That's true. But now, you're missing the point that I was trying to make, is that if something happens and we actually have a war, which eventually is going to come to that.
Right.
Where are we going to get our steel and where are we going to get our aluminum?
Well, let me tell you this.
You asked a question.
Hang on just a second. How much aluminum is mined in the United States?
No, we're talking about
none.
Zero.
Okay,
that's
so
the real issue.
If you want to address
hang on a minute. Bauxite.
Can you shut up just a minute and let me speak? Just be quiet a moment. If you wanted to do a tariff to protect national security, then the tariff should be on imports of bauxite. Open up the mines where we can actually have a source of aluminum in the United States. It is, in fact, aluminum in the United States is more expensive to pull out of the ground than somewhere else because we've used up our easily accessible bauxite. Now, but if you look at that, where do we get the bauxite mainly? Do you know?
I do. He's gone.
He's gone?
Yeah.
Okay. We get the bauxite mainly from Australia. Now, it's not the majority, but that's our number one source of bauxite. So do we really want to – Australia's got treaty obligations and everything else to associate with us. And this is the other thing. The Defense Department – you're going to think this is amazing – doesn't use – almost exclusively doesn't use American-made steel and aluminum. And we got another caller on 773-1400. Go ahead. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, you guys hung up on me.
Yes, we did.
I didn't hang up.
That's because you wouldn't you wouldn't let me talk. You interrupt me.
Well, if you guys would talk one at a time, it'd be a whole lot easier, and then people could understand what you're saying. But when y'all double deck or somebody, that's not good for a radio station. What I was trying to say was aluminum is not something that you get out of the ground. Bauxite comes out of the ground, and most of the bauxite that we get is either from Australia or South America. And the South America plant's been there forever.
Have you been listening to this program?
Every Saturday, I listen to you yokels talk.
All right.
Now,
no need to call us names, but it is fine. Here's the deal. When we were talking, about where we get the bauxite. You missed it because... We're getting rid of you.
Now, let me say something. There's a way to recognize logically, rationally, and appropriately national security issues. And yes, if you want to look at materials that we need from a defense point of view, manganese is high on the list, and we just don't have any and don't mine any. So there are ways to address the national security issues, and there are ways that you just start a trade war for political reasons. And the actions that have occurred in the last this month so far are, as I said, I'm not questioning the fact that there's a fly in here, and it's a great irritant. And the irritant is the fact that we have a lot of more imports than we do exports in some areas. We have a country that's trying to steal intellectual property rights from us. But to go out and publicly insult and threaten
and makes false statements about our allies is not good policy by anybody's stretch of the imagination.
Let's recognize what the real problem is here. There's a couple of real problems, and let me say some alternatives to tariffs. We've got to play some commercials too. Couple of problems. Number one, bauxite. We're importing 100% of our bauxite. We have a lot of places that we could mine for bauxite. We've got a lot of environmental rules preventing us from mining it the same way that they're doing it in Australia or in South America or in the Caribbean. We can still do it better. This was a whole deal with fracking. We just had to figure out how to do it better. We have given up on it. That's the major issue. Putting a tariff on someone else's aluminum doesn't fix it, because we're just going to have to import more bauxite. It's going to make the imbalance even greater. So what we're saying here is that there's a lot more nuance to this than just saying across the board steel and aluminum. The law that was passed in 1962 is a good law. It's an antiquated law, and it came before the World Trade Organization, but we need to be able to protect our strategic ability to build and create weaponry in the event of a war. To put a tariff on steel and aluminum is not where the tariff should go. So let's go back. Let's just take a step back. The second issue is technology. Most of our steel and aluminum manufacturing facilities in the United States, closed or opened, are using a much older technology than is common elsewhere. And guess who invented that new technology that is common elsewhere? Americans did. But it was too expensive to scrap existing plants for a marginal shift in profit until that marginal shift in profit put a lot of plants out of business. So this is a classic case of new technology disrupting old technology, and we didn't move along. In many other areas of technology, we're the first to disrupt ourselves. In this case, other people have disrupted us because we were kind of lax here. Alcoa did not devise new ways of creating aluminum for cheaper. They should have. They should have spent the profits that they had before on devising new ways of doing aluminum. Now, we need to preserve our ability to create the stuff. Don't get me wrong there. What's another way to do it? Well, what we've done with solar panels is not extremely effective, but it's more effective than tariffs, and that is subsidizing the new technology as it comes out. That's not something that we're doing right now. And we've got to play some commercials.
We do.
We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, but please remember this is our program, and interrupt us enough times and we're going to hang up. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, the number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Oh, no more. Hey, let me follow up something on this aluminum issue. The U.S. imports 33% of the aluminum metal that we use as of the latest data that's available. Now, that's admittedly a couple of years old, but still, it's as accurate as we can get. Of that imported aluminum, 63% comes from Canada. In other words, we, not counting Canada, which I don't think is a security threat, I think that in time of war, they would give us all the imported aluminum that we wanted. Not counting Canada, then, we import maybe 10%, 12% of our aluminum from someplace else. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Are you available to switch subjects a little bit? You must have another
subject. Sure. Go ahead.
Your wealth coach, they got unsecured credit. Should I go bankrupt on a bunch of $10,000 or $13,000 worth of credit cards?
You are talking to the wrong program.
Lawyer, I need that Ed Laughlin program.
You need, yeah, very frankly, if you're considering bankruptcy, We don't give legal advice, but obviously Ed Laughlin talks about it all the time, and he says all the time, you're welcome to give him a call and have a free consultation.
Yeah, what we can say is that the unsecured credit will be bad on your credit report for not paying it, but they because it's unsecured, they can't come and take it.
I have no idea what the lawful terms that they can come after me for, because
right.
My bankruptcy.
You need to talk to a lawyer. And there was a program, there's a program that's normally right before ours with a guy called Ask a Lawyer, and that's exactly what you need to do.
Well, that's that. Back to Alcoa. What happened to the Alcoa plant here in Texas? Do you have any idea?
It became there's two issues, and probably the primary issue was that they were using soft coal that they dug out of the ground here in Central Texas, and that is one very polluting, lots of sulfur into the air, and the expense of cleaning up the coal versus the international price of aluminum, or the price of aluminum that you could get from places that use hydroelectric power to do it, such as Canada, they just couldn't compete.
Well, it'd be more really cool if they could just pipe in some natural gas, couldn't they?
Right. Well, that's the next step, but hydroelectric is still cheaper.
What you've got is a lot of hydroelectric plants, particularly in Canada, are really a long ways from the place where electricity is used. So if you can move the aluminum manufacturing to where the electricity is,
you lose
you can produce a lot of you can produce a lot of aluminum for a low price.
And we're about out of time for this hour. No, we got a hard break coming up.
Scrap and aluminum cans are 45, 48 cents. Here in Killeen, they're 48 cents, 45 and 10.
Yeah, that may chance. That may fall, by the way, but go ahead. Thank you.
It may fall. I hope it goes up.
Well, China is slapping a tariff on imported scrap aluminum.
I better cash in Monday then.
Thanks for the call. If you would like to talk to us off the air, in a much less confrontational way, I'm sure, you can contact our office. There's voicemail waiting locally during the weekends, real live people during the week.
We're, of course, area code 254, and it's 947-1111.
You can reach that same line toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There you will see podcasts of this program and many others. You can read our philosophy, our newsletters, see our made-for-radio faces, and our beautiful staff. If you would like to email us directly, you can do that, and we read it. It's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth.
KTEM, AM 1400, Temple, Texas. Tune in with Alexa Skills. Learn how at ktemnews.com.